make it impossible to determine from which down-converter a given idler photon emerged. What if, that is, we erase the which-path information embodied by the idler photons? Well, something amazing happens. Even though we've done nothing directly to the signal photons, by erasing the which-path information carried by their idler partners, we can recover an interference pattern from the signal photons. Let me show you how this goes, because it is truly remarkable. Let's compare setup A, which does not yield an interference pattern, with setup B, which does produce an interference pattern. Setup B differs from that of setup A with regard to how we detect the idler photons after they've been emitted. In setup A, we detected them straight out, and so we could immediately determine from which down-converter each was produced, that is, which path a given signal photon took. In the new experiment, setup B, each idler photon is sent through a maze, which compromises our ability to make such a determination. For example, imagine that an idler photon is emitted from the down-converter labeled L. Rather than immediately entering a detector, as in setup A, this photon is sent to a beam splitter, labeled small a, and so has a 50% chance of heading onward along the path labeled A, and a 50% chance of heading onward along the path labeled B. Should it head along path A, it will enter a photon detector, labeled 1, and its arrival will be duly recorded. But should the idler photon head along path B, it will be subject to yet further shenanigans. It will be directed to another beam splitter, labeled small c, and so will have a 50% chance of heading onward along path E to the detector labeled 2, and a 50% chance of heading onward along path F to the detector labeled 3. Now, stay with me, as there is a point to all this. The exact same reasoning, when applied to an idler photon emitted from the other down-converter, labeled R, tells us that if the idler heads along path D, it will be recorded by detector 4. But if it heads along path C, it will be detected by either detector 3 or detector 2, depending on the path it follows after passing through beam splitter small b. Now for why we've added all this complication. Notice that if an idler photon is detected by detector 1, we learn that the corresponding signal photon took the left path, since there is no way for an idler that was emitting from down-converter R to find its way to this detector. Similarly, if an idler photon is detected by detector 4, we learn that its signal photon partner took the right path. But if an idler photon winds up in detector 2, we have no idea which path its signal photon partner took, since there is an equal chance that it was emitted by down-converter L and followed path B through E, or that it was emitted by down-converter R and followed path C through E. Similarly, if an idler is detected by detector 3, it could have been emitted by down-converter L and have traveled path B through F, or by down-converter R and traveled path C through F. Thus, for signal photons whose idlers are detected by detector 1 or 4, we have which-path information. But for those whose idlers are detected by detector 2 or 3, the which-path information is erased. Does this erasure of some of the which-path information, even though we've done nothing directly to the signal photons, mean interference effects are recovered? Indeed it does. But only for those signal photons whose idlers wind up in either detector 2 or detector 3. Namely, the totality of impact positions of the signal photons on the screen will look like the data in setup A, showing not the slightest hint of an interference pattern, as is characteristic of photons that have traveled one path or the other. But if we focus on a subset of the data points, for example, those signal photons whose idlers entered detector 2, then that subset of points will fill out an interference pattern. These signal photons, whose idlers happened, by chance, not to provide any which-path information, act as though they've traveled both paths. If we were to hook up the equipment so that the screen displays a red dot for the position of each signal photon whose idler was detected by detector 2, and a green dot for all others, someone who is colorblind would see no interference pattern. But everyone else would see that the red dots were arranged with bright and dark bands. An interference pattern. The same holds true with detector 3 in place of detector 2. But there would be no such interference pattern if we single out signal photons whose idlers wind up in detector 1 or detector 4, since these are the idlers that yield which-path information about their partners. These results, which have been confirmed by experiment, are dazzling. By including down converters that have the potential to provide which-path information, we lose the interference pattern, as in setup A. And without interference, we would naturally conclude that each photon went along either the left path or the right path. But we now learn that this would be a hasty conclusion. By carefully eliminating the potential which-path information carried by some of the idlers, we can coax the data to yield up an interference pattern, indicating that some of the photons actually took both paths. Notice, too, perhaps the most dazzling result of all. The four idler photon detectors can be on the other side of the laboratory, or even on the other side of the universe, since nothing in our discussion depended at all on whether they receive a given idler photon before or after its signal photon partner has hit the screen. Imagine, then, that the four photon detectors are all far away, say 10 light-years away, to be definite, and think about what this entails. You perform the experiment in setup B today, recording, one after another, the impact locations of a huge number of signal photons, and you observe that they show no sign of interference. Now, if someone asks you to explain the data, you might be tempted to say that because of the idler photons, which path information is available, and hence each signal photon definitely went along either the left or the right path, eliminating any possibility of interference. But, as above, this would be a hasty conclusion about what happened. It would be a thoroughly premature description of the past. You see, 10 years later, the four photon detectors will receive, one after another, the idler photons. If you are subsequently informed about which idlers wound up, say, in detector 2, for example, the 1st, 7th, 8th, 12th, etc., idlers to arrive, and if you then go back to data you collected years earlier and highlight the corresponding signal photon locations on the screen, for example, the 1st, 7th, 8th, 12th, etc., signal photons that arrived, you will find that the highlighted data points fill out an interference pattern, thus revealing that those signal photons should be described as having traveled both paths. Alternatively, if 9 years, 364 days after you collected the signal photon data, a practical joker should sabotage the experiment by removing beam splitters A and B, ensuring that when the idler photons arrive the next day, they all go to either detector 1 or detector 4, thus preserving all which-path information. Then, when you receive this information, you will conclude that every signal photon went along either the left path or the right path, and there will be no interference pattern to extract from the signal photon data. Thus, as this discussion forcefully highlights, the story you'd tell to explain the signal photon data depends significantly on measurements conducted 10 years after those data were collected. Again, let me emphasize that the future measurements do not change anything at all about things that took place in your experiment today. The future measurements do not in any way change the data you collected today. But the future measurements do influence the kinds of details you can invoke when you subsequently describe what happened today. before you have the results of the Idler photon measurements, you really can't say anything at all about the which path history of any given signal photon. However, once you have the results, you conclude that signal photons whose Idler partners were successfully used to ascertain which path information can be described as having, years earlier, traveled either left or right. You also conclude that signal photons whose Idler partners had their which path information erased cannot be described as having, years earlier, definitely gone one way or the other. A conclusion you can convincingly confirm by using the newly acquired Idler photon data to expose the previously hidden interference pattern among this latter class of signal photons. We thus see that the future helps shape the story you tell of the past. These experiments are a magnificent affront to our conventional notions of space and time. Something that takes place long after and far away from something else, nevertheless is vital to our description of that something else. By any classical, common-sense reckoning, that's, well, crazy. Of course, that's the point. Classical reckoning is the wrong kind of reckoning to use in a quantum universe. We have learned from the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen discussion that quantum physics is not local in space. If you have fully absorbed that lesson, a tough one to accept in its own right, these experiments, which involve a kind of entanglement across space and through time, may not seem thoroughly outlandish. But by the standards of daily experience, they certainly are. Quantum mechanics and experience. For a few days after I first learned about these experiments, I remember feeling elated. I felt I'd been given a glimpse into a veiled side of reality. Common experience, mundane, ordinary, day-to-day activities, suddenly seemed part of a classical charade, hiding the true nature of our quantum world. The world of the everyday suddenly seemed nothing but an inverted magic act, lulling its audience into believing in the usual familiar conceptions of space and time, while the astonishing truth of quantum reality lay carefully guarded by nature's sleights of hand. In recent years, physicists have expended much effort in trying to explain nature's ruse, to figure out precisely how the fundamental laws of quantum physics morph into the classical laws that are so successful at explaining common experience. In essence, to figure out how the atomic and subatomic shed their magical weirdness when they combine to form macroscopic objects. Research continues, but much has already been learned. Let's look at some aspects of particular relevance to the question of time's arrow, but now from the standpoint of quantum mechanics. Classical mechanics is based on equations that Newton discovered in the late 1600s. Electromagnetism is based on equations Maxwell discovered in the late 1800s. Special relativity is based on equations Einstein discovered in 1905. And general relativity is based on equations he discovered in 1915. What all these equations have in common, and what is central to the dilemma of time's arrow, as explained in the last chapter, is their completely symmetric treatment of past and future. Nowhere in any of these equations is there anything that distinguishes forward time from backward time. Past and future are on an equal footing. Quantum mechanics is based on an equation that Erwin Schrödinger discovered in 1926. You don't need to know anything about this equation beyond the fact that it takes as input the shape of a quantum mechanical probability wave at one moment of time, and allows one to determine what the probability wave looks like at any other time, earlier or later. If the probability wave is associated with a particle, such as an electron, you can use it to predict the probability that, at any specified time, an experiment will find the electron at any specified location. Like the classical laws of Newton, Maxwell, and Einstein, the quantum law of Schrödinger embraces an egalitarian treatment of time future and time past. A movie showing a probability wave starting like this and ending like that could be run in reverse, showing a probability wave starting like that and ending like this. And there would be no way to say that one evolution was right and the other wrong. Both would be equally valid solutions of Schrödinger's equation. Both would represent equally sensible ways in which things could evolve. Of course, the movie now referred to is quite different from the ones used in analyzing the motion of a tennis ball or a splattering egg in the last chapter. Probability waves are not things we can see directly. There are no cameras that can capture probability waves on film. Instead, we can describe probability waves using mathematical equations. And, in our mind's eye, we can imagine the simplest of them having shapes such as mountaintops piercing a layer of fog. But the only access we have to the probability waves themselves is indirect, through the process of measurement. That is, as outlined in Chapter 4, and seen repeatedly in the experiments above, the standard formulation of quantum mechanics describes the unfolding of phenomena using two quite distinct stages. In stage one, the probability wave, or in the more precise language of the field, the wave function, of an object, such as an electron, evolves according to the equation discovered by Schrödinger. This equation ensures that the shape of the wave function changes smoothly and gradually, much as a water wave changes shape as it travels from one side of a lake toward the other. Quantum mechanics, rightly, has a reputation as being anything but smooth and gradual. Rather, as we will see explicitly in later chapters, it reveals a turbulent and jittery microcosmos. The origin of this jitteriness is the probabilistic nature of the wave function. Even though things can be one way at one moment, there is a probability that they will be significantly different a moment later. Not an ever-present jittery quality of the wave function itself. In the standard description of the second stage, we make contact with observable reality by measuring the electron's position. And when we do so, the shape of its wave function sharply and abruptly changes. The electron's wave function is unlike more familiar examples like water waves and sound waves. When we measure the electron's position, its wave function spikes, or it collapses, dropping to the value zero everywhere the particle is not found, and surging to 100% probability at the single location where the particle is found by the measurement. Stage 1, the evolution of wave functions according to Schrödinger's equation, is mathematically rigorous, totally unambiguous, and fully accepted by the physics community. Stage 2, the collapse of a wave function upon measurement, is, to the contrary, something that during the last 8 decades has, at best, kept physicists mildly bemused, and at worst, posed problems, puzzles, and potential paradoxes that have devoured careers. The difficulty, as mentioned at the end of Chapter 4, is that according to Schrödinger's equation, wave functions do not collapse. Wave function collapse is an add-on. It was introduced after Schrödinger discovered his equation, in an attempt to account for what experimenters actually see. Whereas a raw, uncollapsed wave function embodies the strange idea that a particle is here and there, experimenters never see this. They always find a particle definitely at one location or another. They never see it partially here and partially there. The needle on their measuring devices never hovers in some ghostly mixture of pointing at this value and also at that value. The same goes, of course, for our own casual observations of the world around us. We never observe a chair to be both here and there. We never observe the moon to be in one part of the night sky as well as another. We never see a cat that is both dead and alive. The notion of wave function collapse aligns with our experience by postulating that the act of measurement induces the wave function to relinquish quantum limbo and usher one of the many potentialities, particle here or particle there, into reality. The quantum measurement puzzle. But how does an experimenter's making a measurement cause a wave function to collapse? In fact, Does wave function collapse really happen? And if it does, what really goes on at the microscopic level? Do any and all measurements cause collapse? When does the collapse happen, and how long does it take? Since, according to the Schrödinger equation, wave functions do not collapse, what equation takes over in the second stage of quantum evolution? And how does the new equation dethrone Schrödinger's, usurping its usual ironclad power over quantum processes? And of importance to our current concern with time's arrow, while Schrödinger's equation, the equation that governs the first stage, makes no distinction between forward and backward in time, does the equation for stage two introduce a fundamental asymmetry between time before and time after a measurement is carried out? That is, does quantum mechanics, including its interface with the world of the everyday via measurements and observations, introduce an arrow of time into the basic laws of physics? After all, we discussed earlier how the quantum treatment of the past differs from that of classical physics. And by past, we meant before a particular observation or measurement had taken place. So do measurements, as embodied by stage two wave function collapse, establish an asymmetry between past and future, between before and after a measurement is made? These questions have stubbornly resisted complete solution, and they remain controversial. Yet, through the decades, the predictive power of quantum theory has hardly been compromised. The stage one, stage two formulation of quantum theory, even though stage two has remained mysterious, predicts probabilities for measuring one outcome or another. And these predictions have been confirmed by repeating a given experiment over and over again, and examining the frequency with which one or another outcome is found. The fantastic experimental success of this approach has far outweighed the discomfort of not having a precise articulation of what actually happens in stage two. But the discomfort has always been there. And it is not simply that some details of wave function collapse have not quite been worked out. The quantum measurement problem, as it is called, is an issue that speaks to the limits and the universality of quantum mechanics. It's simple to see this. The stage one, stage two approach introduces a split between what's being observed, an electron or a proton, or an atom, for example, and the experimenter who does the observing. Before the experimenter gets into the picture, wave functions happily and gently evolve according to Schrödinger's equation. But then, when the experimenter meddles with things to perform a measurement, the rules of the game suddenly change. Schrödinger's equation is cast aside, and stage two collapse takes over. Yet, since there is no difference between the atoms, protons, and electrons that make up the experimenter and the equipment he or she uses, and the atoms, protons, and electrons that he or she studies, why in the world is there a split in how quantum mechanics treats them? If quantum mechanics is a universal theory that applies without limitations to everything, the observed and the observer should be treated in exactly the same way. Niels Bohr disagreed. He claimed that experimenters and their equipment are different from elementary particles. Even though they are made from the same particles, they are big collections of elementary particles, and hence governed by the laws of classical physics. Somewhere between the tiny world of individual atoms and subatomic particles and the familiar world of people and their equipment, the rules change because the sizes change. The motivation for asserting this division is clear. A tiny particle, according to quantum mechanics, can be located in a fuzzy mixture of here and there. Yet we don't see such behavior in the big, everyday world. But exactly where is the border? And, of vital importance, how do the two sets of rules interface when the big world of the everyday confronts the minuscule world of the atomic? Bohr forcefully declared these questions to be out of bounds, by which he meant, truth be told, that they were beyond the bounds of what he or anyone else could answer. And since even without addressing them, the theory makes astonishingly accurate predictions, for a long time such issues were far down on the list of critical questions that physicists were driven to settle. But to understand quantum mechanics completely, to determine fully what it says about reality, and to establish what role it might play in setting a direction to time zero, we must come to grips with the quantum measurement problem. In the next two sections, we'll describe some of the most prominent and promising attempts to do so. The upshot, should you at any point want to rush ahead to the last section focusing on quantum mechanics and the arrow of time, is that much ingenious work on the quantum measurement problem has yielded significant progress, but a broadly accepted solution still seems just beyond our reach. Many view this as the single most important gap in our formulation of quantum law. Reality and the quantum measurement problem. Over the years, there have been many proposals for solving the quantum measurement problem. Ironically, although they entail differing conceptions of reality, some drastically different, when it comes to predictions for what a researcher will measure in most every experiment, they all agree and each one works like a charm. Each proposal puts on the same show, even though, were you to peek backstage, you'd see that their modi operandi differ substantially. When it comes to entertainment, you generally don't want to know what's happening off in the wings. You are perfectly content to focus solely on the production. But when it comes to understanding the universe, there is an insatiable urge to pull back all curtains, open all doors, and expose completely the deep inner workings of reality. Bohr considered this urge baseless and misguided. To him, reality was the performance. Like a Spalding Gray soliloquy, an experimenter's bare-bones measurements are the whole show. There isn't anything else. According to Bohr, there is no backstage. Trying to analyze how and when and why a quantum wave function relinquishes all but one possibility and produces a single definite number on a measuring device is missing the point. The measured number itself is all that's worthy of attention. For decades, this perspective held sway. However, its cumulative effect on the mind struggling with quantum theory notwithstanding, one can't help feeling that the fantastic predictive power of quantum mechanics means that it is tapping into a hidden reality that underlies the workings of the universe. One can't help wanting to go further and understand how quantum mechanics interfaces with common experience, how it bridges the gap between wave function and observation, and what hidden reality underlies the observations. Over the years, a number of researchers have taken up this challenge. Here are some proposals they've developed. One approach, with historical roots that go back to Heisenberg, is to abandon the view that wave functions are objective features of quantum reality, and instead view them merely as an embodiment of what we know about reality. Before we perform a measurement, we don't know where the electron is, and, this view proposes, our ignorance of its location is reflected by the electron's wave function describing it as possibly being at a variety of different positions. At the moment we measure its position, though, our knowledge of its whereabouts suddenly changes. We now know its position, in principle, with total precision. By the uncertainty principle, if we know its location, we will necessarily be completely ignorant of its velocity. But that's not an issue for the current discussion. This sudden change in our knowledge, according to this perspective, is reflected in a sudden change in the electron's wave function. It suddenly collapses and takes on a spiked shape, indicating our definite knowledge of the electron's position. In this approach, then, the abrupt collapse of a wave function is completely unsurprising. It is nothing more than the abrupt change in knowledge that we all experience when we learn something new. A second approach, initiated in 1957 by Wheeler's student Hugh Everett, denies that wave functions ever collapse. Instead, Each and every potential outcome embodied in a wave function sees the light of day. The daylight each sees, however, streams through its own separate universe. In this approach, the many worlds interpretation, the concept of the universe is enlarged to include innumerable parallel universes, innumerable versions of our universe, so that anything that quantum mechanics predicts could happen, even if only with minuscule probability, does happen in at least one of the copies. If a wave function says that an electron can be here, there, and way over there, then, in one universe, a version of you will find it here. In another universe, another copy of you will find it there. And in a third universe, yet another you will find the electron way over there. The sequence of observations that we each make from 1 second to the next thus reflects the reality taking place in but one part of this gargantuan, infinite network of universes. Each one populated by copies of you and me and everyone else who is still alive in a universe in which certain observations have yielded certain outcomes. In one such universe, you are now reading these words. In another, you've taken a break to surf the web. In yet another, you're anxiously awaiting the curtain to rise for your Broadway debut. It's as though there isn't a single space-time block, but an infinite number, with each realizing one possible course of events. In the many worlds approach, then, no potential outcome remains merely a potential. Wave functions don't collapse. Every potential outcome comes out in one of the parallel universes. A third proposal, developed in the 1950s by David Bohm, the same physicist we encountered in Chapter 4 when discussing the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox, takes a completely different approach. Bohm argued that particles, such as electrons, do possess definite positions and definite velocities, just as in classical physics, and just as Einstein had hoped. But in keeping with the uncertainty principle, these features are hidden from view. They are examples of the hidden variables mentioned in Chapter 4. You can't determine both simultaneously. For Bohm, such uncertainty represented a limit on what we can know, but implied nothing about the actual attributes of the particles themselves. His approach does not fall afoul of Bell's results because, as we discussed toward the end of Chapter 4, possessing definite properties forbidden by quantum uncertainty is not ruled out. Only locality is ruled out, and Bohm's approach is not local. Instead, Bohm imagined that the wave function of a particle is another, separate element of reality, one that exists in addition to the particle itself. It's not particles or waves, as in Bohr's complementarity philosophy. According to Bohm, it's particles and waves. Moreover, Bohm posited that a particle's wave function interacts with the particle itself. It guides or pushes the particle around in a way that determines its subsequent motion. While this approach agrees fully with the successful predictions of standard quantum mechanics, Bohm found that changes to the wave function in one location are able to immediately push a particle at a distant location, a finding that explicitly reveals the non-locality of his approach. In the double-slit experiment, for example, each particle goes through one slit or the other, while its wave function goes through both and suffers interference. Since the wave function guides the particle's motion, it should not be terribly surprising that the equations show the particle is likely to land where the wave function value is large, and it is unlikely to land where it is small. In Bohm's approach, there is no separate stage of wave function collapse, since if you measure a particle's position and find it here, that is truly where it was a moment before the measurement took place. A fourth approach, developed by the Italian physicists Giancarlo Girardi, Alberto Rimini, and Tullio Weber, makes the bold move of modifying Schrödinger's equation in a clever way that results in hardly any effect on the evolution of wave functions for individual particles, but has a dramatic impact on quantum evolution when applied to big, everyday objects. The proposed modification envisions that wave functions are inherently unstable. Even without any meddling, these researchers suggest, sooner or later, every wave function collapses, of its own accord, to a spiked shape. For an individual particle, Girardi, Rimini, and Weber postulate that wave function collapse happens spontaneously and randomly, kicking in, on average, only once every billion years or so. This is so infrequent that it entails only the slightest change to the usual quantum mechanical description of individual particles. And that's good, since quantum mechanics describes the microworld with unprecedented accuracy. But for large objects, such as experimenters and their equipment, which have billions and billions of particles, the odds are high that, in a tiny fraction of any given second, the posited spontaneous collapse will kick in for at least one constituent particle, causing its wave function to collapse. And, as argued by Girardi, Rimini, Weber, and others, the entangled nature of all the individual wave functions in a large object ensures that this collapse initiates a kind of quantum domino effect in which the wave functions of all the constituent particles collapse as well. As this happens in a brief fraction of a second, the proposed modification ensures that large objects are essentially always in one definite configuration. Pointers on measuring equipment always point to one definite value. The moon is always at one definite location in the sky. Brains inside experimenters always have one definite experience. Cats are always either dead or alive. Each of these approaches, as well as a number of others we won't discuss, has its supporters and detractors. The wave function as knowledge approach finesses the issue of wave function collapse by denying any reality for wave functions, turning them instead into mere descriptors of what we know. But why, a detractor asks, should fundamental physics be so closely tied to human awareness? If we were not here to observe the world, would wave functions never collapse? Or perhaps, would the very concept of a wave function not exist? Was the universe a vastly different place before human consciousness evolved on planet Earth? What if, instead of human experimenters, mice or ants or amoebas or computers are the only observers? Is the change in their knowledge adequate to be associated with the collapse of a wave function? By contrast, the many worlds interpretation avoids the whole matter of wave function collapse, since, in this approach, wave functions don't collapse. But the price to pay is an enormous proliferation of universes, something that many a detractor has found intolerably exorbitant. Bohm's approach also avoids wave function collapse, but its detractors claim, in granting independent reality to both particles and waves, the theory lacks economy. Moreover, the detractors correctly argue, in Bohm's formulation, the wave function can exert faster-than-light influences on the particles it pushes. Supporters note that the former complaint is subjective at best, and the latter conforms to the non-locality Bell proved unavoidable. So neither criticism is convincing. Nevertheless, perhaps unjustifiably, Bohm's approach has never caught on. The Girardi-Rimini-Weber approach deals with wave function collapse directly, by changing the equations to incorporate a new spontaneous collapse mechanism. But, detractors point out, there is as yet not a shred of experimental evidence supporting the proposed modification to Schrödinger's equation. Research seeking a solid and fully transparent connection between the formalism of quantum mechanics and the experience of everyday life will no doubt go on for some time to come. And it's hard to say which, if any, of the known approaches will ultimately achieve a majority consensus. were physicists to be polled today, I don't think there would be an overwhelming favorite. Unfortunately, experimental input is of limited help. While the Girardi-Rimini-Weber proposal does make predictions that can, in certain situations, differ from standard Stage 1/Stage 2 quantum mechanics, the deviations are too small to be tested with today's technology. The situation with the other three proposals is worse, because they stymie experimental adjudication even more definitively. They agree fully with the standard approach, and so each yields the same predictions for things that can be observed and measured. They differ only regarding what happens backstage, as it were. They only differ, that is, regarding what quantum mechanics implies for the underlying nature of reality. Even though the quantum measurement problem remains unsolved, during the last few decades, a framework has been under development that, while still incomplete, has widespread support as a likely ingredient of any viable solution. It's called decoherence. Decoherence and quantum reality. When you first encounter the probabilistic aspect of quantum mechanics, a natural reaction is to think that it is no more exotic than the probabilities that arise in coin tosses or roulette wheels. But when you learn about quantum interference, you realize that probability enters quantum mechanics in a far more fundamental way. In everyday examples, various outcomes, head versus tails, red versus black, one lottery number versus another, are assigned probabilities with the understanding that one or another result will definitely happen, and that each result is the end product of an independent, definite history. When a coin is tossed, sometimes the spinning motion is just right for the toss to come out heads, and sometimes it's just right for the toss to come out tails. The 50-50 probability we assign to each outcome refers not just to the final result, heads or tails, but also to the histories that lead to each outcome. Half of the possible ways you can toss a coin result in heads, and half result in tails. The histories themselves, though, are totally separate, isolated alternatives. There is no sense in which different motions of the coin reinforce each other or cancel each other out. They're all independent. But in quantum mechanics, things are different. The alternate paths an electron can follow from the two slits to the detector are not separate, isolated histories. The possible histories commingle to produce the observed outcome. Some paths reinforce each other, while others cancel each other out. Such quantum interference between the various possible histories is responsible for the pattern of light and dark bands on the detector screen. Thus, the telltale difference between the quantum and the classical notions of probability is that the former is subject to interference and the latter is not. Decoherence is a widespread phenomenon that forms a bridge between the quantum physics of the small and the classical physics of the not-so-small, by suppressing quantum interference, that is, by diminishing sharply the core difference between quantum and classical probabilities. The importance of decoherence was realized way back in the early days of quantum theory, but its modern incarnation dates from a seminal paper by the German physicist Dieter Zey in 1970, and has since been developed by many researchers, including Eric Jos, also from Germany, and Wojciech Zurek, of the Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico. Here's the idea. When Schrödinger's equation is applied in a simple situation, such as single, isolated photons passing through a screen with two slits, it gives rise to the famous interference pattern. But there are two very special features of this laboratory example that are not characteristic of real-world happenings. First, the things we encounter in day-to-day life are larger and more complicated than a single photon. Second, the things we encounter in day-to-day life are not isolated. They interact with us and with the environment. This book is subject to human contact, and more generally is continually struck by photons and air molecules. Moreover, since the book itself is made of many molecules and atoms, these constantly jittering constituents are continually bouncing off each other as well. The same is true for pointers on measuring devices, for cats, for human brains, and for just about everything you encounter in daily life. On astrophysical scales, the Earth, the Moon, asteroids, and the other planets are continually bombarded by photons from the Sun. Even a grain of dust floating in the darkness of outer space is subject to continual hits from low-energy microwave photons that have been streaming through space since a short time after the Big Bang. And so, to understand what quantum mechanics says about real-world happenings, as opposed to pristine laboratory experiments, we should apply Schrödinger's equation to these more complex, messier situations. In essence, this is what Zay emphasized, and his work, together with that of many others who have followed, has revealed something quite wonderful. Although photons and air molecules are too small to have any significant effect on the motion of a big object, like this book or a cat, they are able to do something else. They continually nudge the big object's wave function, or, in physics speak, they disturb its coherence. They blur its orderly sequence of crest, followed by trough, followed by crest. This is critical, because a wave function's orderliness is central to generating interference effects. And so, much as adding tagging devices to the double-slit experiment blurs the resulting wave function, and thereby washes out interference effects, the constant bombardment of objects by constituents of their environment also washes out the possibility of interference phenomena. In turn, once quantum interference is no longer possible, the probabilities inherent to quantum mechanics are, for all practical purposes, just like the probabilities inherent to coin tosses and roulette wheels. Once environmental decoherence blurs a wave function, the exotic nature of quantum probabilities melts into the more familiar probabilities of day-to-day life. This suggests a resolution of the quantum measurement puzzle, one that, if realized, would be just about the best thing we could hope for. I'll describe it first in the most optimistic light, and then stress what still needs to be done. If a wave function for an isolated electron shows that it has, say, a 50% chance of being here and a 50% chance of being there, we must interpret these probabilities using the full-fledged weirdness of quantum mechanics. Since both of the alternatives can reveal themselves by commingling and generating an interference pattern, we must think of them as equally real. In loose language, there's a sense in which the electron is at both locations. What happens now if we measure the electron's position with a non-isolated, everyday-sized laboratory instrument? Well, corresponding to the electron's ambiguous whereabouts, the pointer on the instrument has a 50% chance of pointing to this value, and a 50% chance of pointing to that value. But because of decoherence, the pointer will not be in a ghostly mixture of pointing at both values. Because of decoherence, we can interpret these probabilities in the usual, classical, everyday sense. Just as a coin has a 50% chance of landing heads and a 50% chance of landing tails, but lands either heads or tails, the pointer has a 50% chance of pointing to this value and a 50% chance of pointing to that value. But it will definitely point to one or the other. Similar reasoning applies for all other complex, non-isolated objects. If a quantum calculation reveals that a cat, sitting in a closed box, has a 50% chance of being dead and a 50% chance of being alive, because there is a 50% chance that an electron will hit a booby-trap mechanism that subjects the cat to poison gas, and a 50% chance that the electron misses the booby-trap, decoherence suggests that the cat will not be in some absurd mixed state of being both dead and alive. Although decades of heated debate have been devoted to issues like, What does it mean for a cat to be both dead and alive? How does the act of opening the box and observing the cat force it to choose a definite status, dead or alive? Decoherence suggests that long before you open the box, the environment has already completed billions of observations that, in almost no time at all, turned all mysterious quantum probabilities into their less mysterious classical counterparts. Long before you look at it, the environment has compelled the cat to take on one single definite condition. Decoherence forces much of the weirdness of quantum physics to leak from large objects, since, bit by bit, the quantum weirdness is carried away by the innumerable impinging particles from the environment. It's hard to imagine a more satisfying solution to the quantum measurement problem. By being more realistic and abandoning the simplifying assumption that ignores the environment, a simplification that was crucial to making progress during the early development of the field, we would find that quantum mechanics has a built-in solution. Human consciousness, human experimenters, and human observations would no longer play a special role, since we, would simply be elements of the environment, like air molecules and photons, which can interact with a given physical system. There would also no longer be a stage one, stage two split between the evolution of the objects and the experimenter who measures them. Everything, observed and observer, would be on an equal footing. Everything, observed and observer, would be subject to precisely the same quantum mechanical law as is set down in Schrödinger's equation. The act of measurement would no longer be special. It would merely be one specific example of contact with the environment. Is that it? Does decoherence resolve the quantum measurement problem? Is decoherence responsible for wave functions closing the door on all but one of the potential outcomes to which they can lead? Some think so. Researchers like Robert Griffiths of Carnegie Mellon, Roland Omnes of Orsay, the Nobel laureate Murray Gell-Mann of the Santa Fe Institute, and Jim Hartle of the University of California at Santa Barbara, have made great progress and claim that they have developed decoherence into a complete framework, called decoherent histories, that solves the measurement problem. Others, like myself, are intrigued but not yet fully convinced. You see, the power of decoherence is that it successfully removes the artificial barrier Bohr erected between large and small physical systems, making everything subject to the same quantum mechanical formulas. This is important progress, and I think Bohr would have found it gratifying. Although the unresolved quantum measurement problem never diminished the physicist's ability to reconcile theoretical calculations with experimental data, it did lead Bohr and his colleagues to articulate a quantum mechanical framework with some distinctly awkward features. Many found the framework's need for fuzzy words about wave function collapse, or the imprecise notion of large systems belonging to the dominion of classical physics, unnerving. To a significant extent, by taking account of decoherence, researchers have rendered these vague ideas unnecessary. However, a key issue that I skirted in the description above is that even though decoherence suppresses quantum interference and thereby coaxes weird quantum probabilities to be like their familiar classical counterparts, each of the potential outcomes embodied in a wave function still vies for realization. And so we are still left wondering how one outcome wins and where the many other possibilities go when that actually happens. When a coin is tossed, classical physics gives an answer to the analogous question. It says that if you examine the way the coin is set spinning with adequate precision, you can, in principle, predict whether it will land heads or tails. On closer inspection, then, precisely one outcome is determined by details you initially overlooked. The same cannot be said in quantum physics. Decoherence allows quantum probabilities to be interpreted much like classical ones, but does not provide any finer details that select one of the many possible outcomes to actually happen. Much in the spirit of Bohr, some physicists believe that searching for such an explanation of how a single definite outcome arises is misguided. These physicists argue that quantum mechanics, with its updating to include decoherence, is a sharply formulated theory whose predictions account for the behavior of laboratory measuring devices. And according to this view, that is the goal of science. To seek an explanation of what's really going on, to strive for an understanding of how a particular outcome came to be, to hunt for a level of reality beyond detector readings and computer printouts, betrays an unreasonable intellectual greediness. Many others, including me, have a different perspective. Explaining data is what science is about. But many physicists believe that science is also about embracing the theories data confirms, and going further by using them to gain maximal insight into the nature of reality. I strongly suspect that there is much insight to be gained by pushing onward toward a complete solution of the measurement problem. Thus, although there is wide agreement that environment-induced decoherence is a crucial part of the structure spanning the quantum to classical divide, and while many are hopeful that these considerations will one day coalesce into a complete and cogent connection between the two, far from everyone is convinced that the bridge has yet been fully built. Quantum mechanics and the arrow of time. So, where do we stand on the measurement problem? And what does it mean for the arrow of time? Broadly speaking, there are two classes of proposals for linking common experience with quantum reality. In the first class, for example, wave function as knowledge, many worlds, decoherence, Schrödinger's equation is the be-all and end-all of the story. The proposals simply provide different ways of interpreting what the equation means for physical reality. In the second class, for example, Bohm, Girardi, Rimini, Weber, Schrödinger's equation must be supplemented with other equations. In Bohm's case, an equation that shows how a wave function pushes a particle around. Or it must be modified, in the Girardi, Rimini, Weber case, to incorporate a new explicit collapse mechanism. A key question for determining the impact on time's arrow is whether these proposals introduce a fundamental asymmetry between one direction in time and the other. Remember, Schrödinger's equation, just like those of Newton, Maxwell, and Einstein, treats forward and backward in time on a completely equal footing. It provides no arrow to temporal evolution. Do any of the proposals change this? In the first class of proposals, the Schrödinger framework is not at all modified, so temporal symmetry is maintained. In the second class, temporal symmetry may or may not survive, depending on the details. For example, in Bohm's approach, the new equation proposed does treat time future and time past on an equal footing, and so no asymmetry is introduced. However, the proposal of Girardi, Rimini, and Weber introduces a collapse mechanism that does have a temporal arrow. An uncollapsing wave function, one that goes from a spiked to a spread-out shape, would not conform to the modified equations. Thus, depending on the proposal, quantum mechanics, together with a resolution to the quantum measurement puzzle, may or may not continue to treat each direction in time equally. Let's consider the implications of each possibility. If time symmetry persists, as I suspect it will, all of the reasoning and all of the conclusions of the last chapter can be carried over with little change to the quantum realm. The core physics that entered our discussion of time's arrow was the time reversal symmetry of classical physics. While the basic language and framework of quantum physics differ from those of classical physics, wave functions instead of positions and velocities, Schrödinger's equation instead of Newton's laws, time reversal symmetry of all quantum equations would ensure that the treatment of time's arrow would be unchanged. Entropy in the quantum world can be defined much as in classical physics, so long as we describe particles in terms of their wave functions. And the conclusion that entropy should always be on the rise, increasing both toward what we call the future and toward what we call the past, would still hold. We would thus come to the same puzzle encountered in Chapter 6. If we take our observations of the world right now as given, as undeniably real, and if entropy should increase both toward the future and toward the past, how do we explain how the world got to be the way it is, and how it will subsequently unfold? And the same two possibilities would present themselves. Either all that we see popped into existence by a statistical fluke that you would expect to happen every so often in an eternal universe that spends the vast majority of its time being totally disordered, or, for some reason, entropy was astoundingly low just following the Big Bang, and for the last 14 billion years, things have been slowly unwinding and will continue to do so toward the future. As in Chapter 6, to avoid the quagmire of not trusting memories, records, and the laws of physics, we focus on the second option, a low-entropy bang, and seek an explanation for how and why things began in such a special state. If, on the other hand, time symmetry is lost, if the resolution of the measurement problem that is one day accepted reveals a fundamental asymmetric treatment of future versus past within quantum mechanics, it could very well provide the most straightforward explanation of time's arrow. It might show, for instance, that eggs splatter but don't unsplatter because, unlike what we found using the laws of classical physics, splattering solves the full quantum equations, but unsplattering doesn't. A reverse-run movie of a splattering egg would then depict motion that couldn't happen in the real world, which would explain why we've never seen it. And that would be that. Possibly. But even though this would seem to provide a very different explanation of time's arrow, in reality, it may not be as different as it appears. As we emphasized in Chapter 6, for the pages of War and Peace to become increasingly disordered, they must begin ordered. For an egg to become disordered through splattering, it must begin as an ordered, pristine egg. For entropy to increase toward the future, entropy must be low in the past, so things have the potential to become disordered. However, just because a law treats past and future differently, does not ensure that the law dictates a past with lower entropy. The law might still imply higher entropy toward the past. Perhaps entropy would increase asymmetrically toward past and future. And it's even possible that a time asymmetric law would be unable to say anything about the past at all. The latter is true of the Girardi-Rimini-Weber proposal, one of the only substantive time asymmetric proposals on the market. Once their collapse mechanism does its trick, there is no way to undo it. There is no way to start from the collapsed wave function and evolve it back to its previous spread-out form. The detailed form of the wave function is lost in the collapse. It turns into a spike. And so it's impossible to retrodict what things were like at any time before the collapse occurred. Thus, even though a time asymmetric law would provide a partial explanation for why things unfold in one temporal order but never in the reverse order, it could very well call for the same key supplement required by time symmetric laws, an explanation for why entropy was low in the distant past. Certainly, this is true of the time asymmetric modifications to quantum mechanics that have so far been proposed. And so, unless some future discovery reveals two features, both of which I consider unlikely, a time asymmetric solution to the quantum measurement problem that, additionally, ensures that entropy decreases toward the past, our effort to explain the arrow of time leads us, once again, back to the origin of the universe, the subject of the part of the book. As these chapters will make clear, cosmological considerations wend their way through many mysteries at the heart of space, time, and matter. So, on the journey toward modern cosmology's insights into time's arrow, it's worth our while not to rush through the landscape, but rather to take a well-considered stroll through cosmic history. Part 3. Space-Time and Cosmology. Chapter 8. Of Snowflakes and Space-Time. Symmetry and the Evolution of the Cosmos. Richard Feynman once said that if he had to summarize the most important finding of modern science in one sentence, he would choose, "The world is made of atoms." When we recognize that so much of our understanding of the universe relies on the properties and interactions of atoms, from the reason that stars shine and the sky is blue, to the explanation for why you feel this book in your hand and see these words with your eyes, we can well appreciate Feynman's choice for encapsulating our scientific legacy. Many of today's leading scientists agree that if they were offered a second sentence, they'd choose, "Symmetry underlies the laws of the universe." During the last few hundred years, there have been many upheavals in science, but the most lasting discoveries have a common characteristic. They've identified features of the natural world that remain unchanged even when subjected to a wide range of manipulations. These unchanging attributes reflect what physicists call symmetries, and they have played an increasingly vital role in many major advances. This has provided ample evidence that symmetry, in all its mysterious and subtle guises, shines a powerful light into the darkness where truth awaits discovery. In fact, we will see that the history of the universe is, to a large extent, the history of symmetry. The most pivotal moments in the evolution of the universe are those in which balance and order suddenly change, yielding cosmic arenas qualitatively different from those of preceding eras. Current theory holds that the universe went through a number of these transitions during its earliest moments, and that everything we've ever encountered is a tangible remnant of an earlier, more symmetric cosmic epoch. But there is an even grander sense, a meta-sense, in which symmetry lies at the core of an evolving cosmos. Time itself is intimately entwined with symmetry. As will become clear, the practical connotation of time as a measure of change, as well as the very existence of a kind of cosmic time that allows us to speak sensibly of things like the age and evolution of the universe as a whole, rely sensitively on aspects of symmetry. And as scientists have examined that evolution, looking back toward the beginning in search of the true nature of space and time, symmetry has established itself as the most sure-footed of guides, providing insights and answers that would otherwise have been completely out of reach. Symmetry and the Laws of Physics. Symmetry abounds. Hold a cube ball in your hand and rotate it this way or that. Spin it around any axis, and it looks exactly the same.